Acts chapter 17, verses 15 through 21, I might ask you this question. Might be interesting to some of you more than to others. Suppose you found yourself in Paris, France, by yourself, and you were waiting on some other people to join you. You weren't really sure when they would be there. It might be several days, might be several weeks. Do you think you could find anything to do? That's really the circumstance that Paul the Apostle found himself in, as we read of his being cast providentially by the will of God into the city of Athens. Acts chapter 17, verses 15 through 21. The Bible tells us that Paul is conducted by believers in Berea to the city of Athens. And the word that's translated conducted has in it the idea to bring one on a journey and to accompany that person out of respect or for reasons of security. And I rather suspect that these men accompany Paul from Berea to Athens because they're concerned about his safety. And the Bible tells us that they left Berea and went, as it were, to the sea, and then went to the city of Athens, which is a distance of about 200 miles from Berea, where Paul has just had to leave because of the trouble that's been stirred there by unbelievers who've been pursuing him for a number of weeks. The Bible tells us that Timothy and Silas stay in the city of Berea, and that when Paul gets to Athens, that he wants Silas and Timothy, and this is recorded in verse 15, to come to him with all speed. And these messengers are men and that have accompanied him from Berea to Athens, are to carry this message back to Timothy and Silas. And that is, they are to come to him with all speed. But you'll notice in chapter 18 and verse 5 that Silas and Timothy were come from Macedonia. Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was Christ. Now, this wasn't in the city of Athens, but it's in the city of Corinth. So obviously they are allowed to rejoin Paul at Athens, or rather at Corinth, rather than at Athens. And this evening we want to think of how Paul waited for Silas and Timothy in the city of Athens. The Bible tells us in verse 16 that while Paul waited for them at Athens. And it means to wait with high expectation. It means to look for. It doesn't mean that he simply said, now they're going to be here sometime and I'm going to go ahead and do the things that I need to do. But it means that Paul was waiting expectantly, as though he wanted them to be with him when he began the work that God called him to do. And that seems to be the fact, that Paul sees himself alone in the city of Athens, and he wants Silas and Timothy to be with him. And so it seems that he's expecting their arrival, and he knows it's going to be a while because it's going to be 200 miles and 200 miles and 400 mile round trip. So he knows it's going to be several days, in fact, weeks. So he tries to sort of rest and relax and and wait for these people to join him so that their ministry can start again. But the Bible tells us that Paul, while he was waiting for Timothy and Silas in the city of Athens, which was really the university city of the world, it was the intellectual capital of the entire world at that particular time, and it had been the dwelling place of many of the great philosophers, and they had taught and walked these streets and had taught in the marketplaces and had taught at this one particular place where they're going to bring Paul, and that is at Mars Hill. So it wasn't as though Paul really didn't have anything to do. It was simply that he's going to wait for them and then start his ministry. But the Bible tells us that Paul saw the city wholly given to idolatry. And it really has in it the idea that Paul evidently had walked around the city of Athens, and he saw that the city was literally filled with idols. That is, it was filled with little statues. It was filled with little places to worship a particular god. And over a period of hundreds of years, this city had accumulated hundreds and hundreds of little temples, large temples, small idols, and idols to all of the many gods that these people worshiped. One historian wrote of the city of Athens that you could find more idols in the city of Athens than you could find men. In other words, it was easier to find an idol than it was to find a man, which leads us to conclude that the population of Athens was more, as from the viewpoint of content, more idols than there were people living in the city. I think today we might say that there are more church buildings than there are churches. And you know what I mean by that. Not simply there are more church buildings than there are people who meet somewhere, but there are more church buildings than there are New Testament churches. But as Paul walked around this city with its magnificent temples, the Parthenon, and all these other architectural wonders and objects of great beauty, the Bible tells us that he was unimpressed and that he saw the city for what it really was, and that his spirit was stirred in him. I believe it's 1977. I had the opportunity to be in Paris, so I've sort of posed a question for myself. And we arrived in Paris on Friday evening, and I wanted to go to church. I hadn't been to a congregation and its gathering for two Sundays, and I wanted to attend church, and finally we were able to locate one. We walked about Paris, France, early that Sunday morning because I had several blocks to walk, probably 2 miles, and we'd been riding a lot, so we thought it would be a good thing to do, to just get the exercise and maybe see some of the city. And we passed a number of huge cathedrals, many, many churches, and most of these were simply tourist attractions. In fact, some of the large cathedrals that we happened to go by that day, there'd be tourist buses lined up. And I asked one of the people who were providing tours for us, aren't there services in these churches anymore, churches like Notre Dame and others? And this lady said, yes, but usually there are very, very few people who ever attend, and most of them are very elderly, and they come early on Sunday morning, like at 6 for the 6 o'clock Mass, and then after that, there are no people who attend these monuments any longer. And so as I looked at Paris, I think I saw things differently than most people did. I didn't really see anything that I cared for, and I actually was grieved to see a city of 11 million people with two small so-called Baptist churches. Paul, the Bible tells us, was stirred by what he saw. And this word means to sharpen by or on anything as by rubbing together, to whet, to be spurred on. And we're talking about a word that means to grind in order to sharpen. And when Paul walked about the city of Athens, his spirit was ground by the idols that he saw until he literally was filled with anger toward the idolatrous worship of these people. And I was immediately reminded of Jesus, who, when overlooking the city of Jerusalem, wept over it. People react differently to different circumstances. Here's Jesus, whose divine heart is moved by compassion when he sees these people who are his genealogical and ethnic counterparts, and he weeps that they have fallen into a state of false religion and false worship. He's angered, Jesus is, when he sees people making the house of prayer, the temple of God, which is to be a house of prayer, a den of thieves, or a place of merchandise. Jesus is angered when he sees that. We see Paul angry. He has paroxysms, that's the word, which we sometimes say a fit of anger. But Paul was deeply moved and angered by what he saw. And he doesn't wait for Silas and Timothy any longer. While Paul waited for them, the Bible tells us that he disputed with the Athenians. Now, there were Athenian Jews, and the Bible tells us that he went into the synagogue in verse 17, and he disputed. Now, this word isn't the word for preaching. It's the word that we get dialogue from. So he engaged in a dialogue with the Jews in the synagogue, which means that he asked them questions, and he asked them questions, and they asked him questions, and they alternately discussed and conversed. But notice these areas of dialogue. He went to the Jews, then with the devout persons, and these evidently were Athenians who were God-fearing, monotheists who believed in Jehovah God. And then the Bible tells us that he disputed with the market goers. And this literally means that Paul went into the marketplace, into the agora, and that he evidently just stood around, and when people came by, he actually asked them, I'm sure, about their religious circumstance and engaged these people in what we would term conversation. Now here's a man waiting in the city of Athens for his companions, his fellow yoke servants. You know, Paul has never, up until this time, as we can tell, been without yoke servants. He's been with Silas, he's been with men of God, he's had their support and strength, but now he's by himself. And it seems that he's struggling a little bit, because the first thing he does, he goes in the synagogue and he has discussions. He discusses the relationship of these God-fearing Gentiles to evidently Christ. And then he just goes out in the marketplace, what we'd call the mall. For want of something to do? Well, I don't think it's that way. I think Paul understood that here's where the people was. So he just went to the mall and stood around and engaged people in conversation. He disputed with them. Now in this circumstance, and the Bible tells us that he met these people in the market daily, and evidently they began to say, well, now that fellow that we talked to yesterday is going to be there at about 10 o'clock, so let's go up there and talk to him again. He evidently began to make some friends and listeners. And then he encountered the philosophers. And these certain philosophers were of the Epicurean and of the Stoics. They evidently heard about Paul meeting in the marketplace with these people who he had encountered by chance. And now these men, who are called Epicureans, philosophers, Stoics, and the word philosopher is a compound word that means lover of wisdom. So these were men who considered themselves to love wisdom or to seek after knowledge. There were the Epicureans. Now, the founder, Epicurus, the founder of the Epicureans, many people misunderstand this man. He believed in what we call the atomic theory. He'd gotten it from Democritus. He believed that men ought to seek what gave pleasure and to avoid what caused pain. So many people get the idea that an Epicurean at the time it was founded by a man who believed totally in sensual pleasure, but he believed that pleasure was best derived from discipline and from being with one's friends and being with one's family. And he established a place in the city of Athens in a very lovely garden. And so people would come and meet him there, and they'd sort of shut the world out, and they would discuss things and have good meals, but they weren't given to drunkenness and things of this nature. So the founder wasn't given to all the sensual pleasure that these people who are his followers some 200 or 300 years later give themselves to. They had perverted Epicureanism. So they're going to dispute with Paul. And then the Stoics, Zeno, who was a philosopher, was quite different in the things he believed. He was a polytheistic person who believed in the forces of fire and earth and water. He didn't believe in life after death. And Zeno taught on the porch, which was a stoa, and therefore these people were called Stoics because this is where they met. And they too had perverted what their original teacher had taught them, until they had come into a very settled form of fatalism. And their attitude was to show no emotion one way or another toward anything. So these two groups, they evidently have heard of what's happening in the marketplace. So they come, they encountered Paul. This is what the scriptures tell us. And this word means to be thrown together, to meet with, to come across. So they probably had heard about Paul, and they arranged this, quote, chance meeting with him. And here are some of their comments. We don't know whether the Epicureans or the Stoics said this, but they make this statement. And some said, "What will this babbler say?" And I believe it's better for us to accept this translation. What would this man say if he could say anything? That is, what is he trying to say? They haven't been listening to him. They've listened to what others have said he said. And they're asking now, what is this man trying to say? What is it that he wants to say? If we gave this man a chance to explain himself, what would he say? And they called him a babbler. Now, the original derivation of the word babbler is of a bird picking up seeds. Just, you know, jumping here and there, picking up seeds. Later it was used to describe what we'd call rag pickers, that is, people who go through garbage cans and who go through the garbage dump picking out things and saving them. You've seen them on the streets. Well, that's the sense that they use this term babbler and directed toward Paul. Here's a man who has gathered a lot of ideas out of the garbage cans of learning. He's just put together some really strange and unique things. And if this man, who is a salvager and a rummager at the in the garbage dump, if he could say what he really wants to say, what would he say? So they said, let's invite him to go somewhere and preach and explain to us these two gods. Now, they said, he preached unto them Jesus. Now, this is what the Bible says, that Paul had preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. Now, remember that these people were people who worshiped and erected idols to, well, such things as philanthropy. That was a god. Also, Zeus, who was the principal god, and Athene, who was the mother of air, and Demeter, who was the mother of the earth, and there were altars to shame, and to rumor, and to philanthropy. They erected gods to concepts as well as to gods or goddesses whom they thought had created things. So they thought that Paul was preaching Jesus as a god and resurrection as a god. And then they said, let's take Paul to this central location. We'll climb the hill where men have stood and explained what they know for century upon century, the great men of Greek philosophy. They had stood there at Mars Hill, or the Areopagus. Let's go and take this man there. Now, they didn't force him to go. The Bible says they took him, but it doesn't mean they got him by the arm and dragged him there. They simply went with him. They escorted him. They all went together. It's sort of like some people coming by when a person's preaching, say, at Southwest Mall and says, look, this guy's got some real weird ideas. Let's all go to Robinson Auditorium and let him get up on the stage with a microphone and take all the people he can take, and we'll take all we can take, and we'll just have a thorough examination and explanation from this man of what he really believes and what he really preaches. And then they made the statement, may we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is. The word new here doesn't mean new in the sense that it's new to them, but it means newly made. It's a brand new doctrine. That is, it's brand new teaching. They assumed that Paul had manufactured some new explanation of the world, of the world's circumstances, and of truth, and of matter, and all of these other things that perplexed men. And they said, for you bring certain strange things to our ears. That is, these things you've said are very strange to us, which means novel and surprising. This word that's translated strange has in the idea of opening the door and finding someone as a guest that you never expected. The doorbell rings you open the door and they say, hello, I'm your lost cousin Henry, and we're here to spend the weekend. And you're surprised. Very novel thing, isn't it? Well, they said, what you're telling us is a surprising thing. It's a very novel idea. If we understand you properly, there's something about a resurrection There's something about a man named Jesus as being new gods, new ideas, very strange to us, very novel, very surprising. And we would like for you to explain to us this new doctrine. And then Luke inserts this parenthetical statement. For all the Athenians and strangers. Now these strangers were the men who had come to Athens to live and work in this university city so they could drink in all of the education and all of the cosmopolitan atmosphere of the city of Athens. For all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. Now this phrase, spent their time, doesn't mean that that's all they did. It simply means that that's how they spent all of their leisure time. It doesn't mean that they didn't have things they had to do, whether they were looking after businesses or whether they were administrators and teachers in schools. It just simply means that they devoted every spare minute that they had, all of their leisure time, to exploring something new. Now, not simply something that was old that they had never heard of, but what they were devoutly interested in was some extremely new thing, some new and novel idea. This intrigued them. The Greeks had primarily rejected the Jewish writings, the oracles of Jehovah God, as a rational explanation concerning the explanation for man and his existence and for matter. And these people had put together many, many ideas, some of them mathematical that had to do with a mechanistic viewpoint of the universe. They were well learned from the viewpoint of that age. In fact, some of the things they did, we still accept and have built upon down through the centuries. But they wanted something new, something perhaps that would help them to understand the universe, to understand man and his destiny, to understand how to accomplish things, some new idea about government, like Plato's Republic, some new thing. This man's got a new twist on the existence of things. Let's hear what he has to say. In verse 22, the Bible tells us, then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill. This is the Areopagus where they took him. And he delivered a message. And we're going to look at that message and to examine it. Because it has the same purpose. It doesn't have the same procedures that Paul followed when he went into the synagogue. Remember the synagogue? That right to Paul's left were all of the scriptures, all rolled up, and you could call for them, and the librarian would take down the scroll and would unroll it to a place, and you could read what Isaiah and Daniel and all the prophets said, what Moses said. And these people were devout believers in one God. And they knew who Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all these people were. They were their progenitors. But here we have an entirely different circumstance. No scrolls to take down and quote from. No basis to build upon in the sense that these people were believers in Jehovah God. It's an entirely different circumstance. But Paul is prepared. God has prepared him because he has a liberal arts education as well as a Jewish theological education. So Paul is cosmopolitan. He is a Greek and he's a Jew. God has uniquely equipped this man whom he called early to teach Jesus Christ not only to the Jews but also to the Greeks. But you're going to find that his conclusion is exactly the same before the Greeks as it was before the Jews. And that is that Jesus is the Lord, that Jesus is the Christ, and that there's not any salvation in any other. And that's the message that Paul gave to them, though he approached it from a different viewpoint. It's the message we preach today. It's the message we preach this evening. And that is, there's no salvation in any other. For there's none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved.